Coming up is the news.
Iran says the International Atomic Energy Agency should not be affected by political objectives some countries are pursuing. A car plows into a crowd during a Christmas parade in the U.S. city of Waukesha, leaving at least five people dead and dozens more wounded. Unrest hits the Netherlands for the third consecutive night amid public anger at the government's coronavirus restrictions. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Now, top story this hour, Iran dismissing the latest U.S. threats against the country. And this after Washington said that of all options on the table, the upcoming talks with the parties to the 2015 nuclear deal fail. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman says that the U.S. has previously carried out as threats in the countries like Afghanistan, and the results are there for everyone to see. Said Khatibzadeh added that Iran's focus on the Vienna talks is the removal of what are called unilateral and tyrannical sanctions. They express hope that the upcoming visit by the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency chief to Iran is constructive as before. The spokesman said that Iran has always called on the agency to pursue technical cooperation and prevent abuse of its name by other countries for their own political agendas. And from London, I'm joined by Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator. Good to have you with us, Mr. Abbas. So let our viewers actually have a better picture of the question why Iran should be so sensitive regarding the upcoming Vienna talks starting on November 29th. I want you to tell our viewers about this. What good reasons does Iran have to be asking for guarantees and things like that?
Well, first of all, the fact that the United States in the first place walked out unilaterally without any notice, that in itself is a big green light. What guarantees do the Iranian establishment have from the rest of the world or the other parties involved, or even the U.S., that the same thing won't happen again as soon as, say, for instance, Joe Biden leaves office, or even during Joe Biden's tenure? What guarantee does the Islamic Republic of Iran have that Israel isn't dictating the American policy in that region? And therefore, if it's Israel that Iran should be negotiating with around nuclear arms, then what's the point of the rest of these nations? And talking of Israel, JCPOA omits, for me, a few very, very important things for the security of Iran. And Iran's already made, I think, huge concessions by even considering the JCPOA agreements, given that, first of all, Israel is the only warhead-equipped nation in West Asia, creating a huge imbalance in geostrategic conditions, and is sanctioned by the Americans and supported by them. It's not the program, the Israeli nuclear program, is not subject to anybody's scrutiny. They're not subject to the NPO. The whole nuclear proliferation agreement isn't binding on them. They don't let you know what they're doing. And yet here we have the hypocrisy of an America that supports a nuclear arms equipped Israel, holding supposedly Iran to account. So that's the first point, why there really can't be a great deal of trust. The Americans have a track record of reneging on treaties. The Paris Agreement, you'll recall the Trans-Pacific Agreement, which was supposed to bring economic peace and harmony with China and the world. That fell through. So I could go through a whole litany of agreements that they've just torn up at a whim. So again, they have track record. The other aspect is the other main belligerent in West Asia, Saudi Arabia, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, is being openly supported by the Americans and the West generally in developing nuclear power, not only supporting it, they're actively encouraging their corporate companies and state apparatus to tender for contracts for nuclear development of Saudi Arabia. How on earth are you going to ask Iran to move away from any kind of nuclear peaceful activity and at the same time tell its key protagonists, the key problem creators within West Asia, that they have carte blanche to absolutely continue? So, you know, just those, you know, would America unilaterally disarm without Russia or China or anybody else doing it? So if the Americans wouldn't do that themselves, the West wouldn't do that themselves, why are they expecting Iran to take part in no kind of nuclear development? And even there, Ayatollah Khamenei said that we, on a matter of religious principle and moral principle, do not want to develop nuclear weapons. We're purely after nuclear energy for our own use, peaceful use. So those are just some of the obvious pointers for me, which say, no, there's a big problem. The EU itself can't point to America. They promised the INSTEX system, which was supposed to kick in to help Iran reduce the problem of American blanket sanctions, the worst sanctions ever imposed on a nation, ever. And they lied, essentially. The EU hasn't triggered the INSTEX system, didn't do anything about it. So you can see that there's a deviousness, there's a underhand alternative kind of dealing with Iran, which is based on their prejudices on so many levels of you know, Iranians, or Iranophobia, Islamophobia, you know, the need to be imperialists and go in and belligerently dominate a region. They want Iran to give up its defense system as well. When is it, how long will it take the Americans to listen to the Israelis again, even if they would sign this agreement, to then move on and say to Iran, oh, well, actually, you know, we don't like what you're doing in the region, with the fact that you even got a geostrategic involvement in the Middle East, which is your neighborhood, is a problem for us. How long will it take for Israel to re-raise those issues? I think far more emphasis by the Americans and the West should be paid on Israel, the local attack dog, which they use to create a disharmony. Iran has never attacked a nation. Not in 200 years plus has Iran invaded any of its neighbors. Yet the West, even though it wants to talk about JCPOA and peace from this point of view, imposes economic terrorism, arms all those nations like Azerbaijan, even now on the borders of Iran, disrupting Iraq, equipping ISIS, having bases lined up all around Iran, which have nuclear and other capacity, no doubt. On what basis is Iran supposed to really trust these guys?
Okay, thank you very much. Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator in London. A car ramming incident during a holiday parade in the U.S. state of Wisconsin has left five people dead. That incident happened in the city of Waukesha, west of Milwaukee. Police saying over 40 people were also injured, but numbers could be revised. Many children were among the victims. A video posted on social media showed a red SUV speeding toward marchers taking part in the city's Christmas parade. It was sped off after mowing them down. Police saying that the vehicle involved has been recovered, and one person of interest is in custody as investigations go on.
An officer did discharge his weapon at the suspect vehicle to try to stop the vehicle. No bystanders were injured as a result of the weapon discharge. We're no longer looking for a suspect vehicle. We do have a person of interest in custody at the moment, but this is still a very fluid investigation.
While it's still not known what the potential motive was or if the incident was related to terrorism, however, a shelter-in-place order issued after the incident in the city has been lifted. Waukesha schools and roads will remain closed on Monday. An official says the White House is closely monitoring the situation there. We'll continue to bring you updates on this story. Now, protests against coronavirus restrictions continue across the Netherlands for the third consecutive night. According to police, 130 people have been arrested. A flashpoint was the city of Enschede, where an emergency order is in place. Protests saw police clash with angry people who set up fireworks and vandalized properties. Authorities saying the Sunday night's unrest was less violent than the ones in the past two nights. The night before, police resorted to water cannons to disperse the ralliers in The Hague. Several officers were injured there. Also on Friday, four people were killed by police live fire in Rotterdam. The demonstrations center around new COVID restrictions, including a potential mandatory vaccination for access to indoor venues. Yemeni people have taken to the streets in different cities to condemn U.S. support of Saudi-led war on their country for years. Protesters slam Washington for being the main contributor to the aggression against Yemen. The protesters in the city of Sada said that all U.S. administrations have sought to exploit Yemen in line with their own interests. The rallies warned that the siege of Yemen would bring Riyadh and allies nothing but greater loss. They pledged that the Yemenis would retaliate against any enmity. Their nearly 7-year Saudi-led war in Yemen has killed thousands of people. Washington and its allies are helping Riyadh in its warmongering, including by selling weapons. A public anger continues to simmer in the U.S. over the acquittal of a militia member who fatally shot two anti-racism protesters in August 2020. In our news review program a short while ago, we've discussed that issue with our guests.
Sign up for our news review segment where we take a look at one of our stories in more detail. Public anger continues to simmer in the United States over the acquittal of a militia member who fatally shot two anti-racism protesters in August 2020. Protesters marched in different cities across the country, condemning the court's verdict that the shootings by Kyle Rittenhouse were in self-defense. In the city of Kenosha, Wisconsin, people gathered for a rally organized by faith leaders and activists to protest the acquittal of Rittenhouse. In Chicago, demonstrators hit the streets chanting Black Lives Matter. They also carried signs reading White Supremacy Equals Terrorism. Protests also erupted in Tampa, Florida, and Minneapolis, Minnesota. The Rittenhouse verdict has sparked fierce criticism of the country's justice system and its preferential, I should say, treatment of white supremacists. So joining us is Colin Campbell, our correspondent in Washington, D.C., and also Life Malcolm, criminal defense and civil rights attorney from Tampa. Gentlemen, welcome. Colin, if I start with you, I guess, how much damage has this verdict done? The reaction from activists, gun control groups, civil rights leaders, politicians have not been positive at all, with the exception of some right-wing Republicans.
Okay, so when you say damage, I'm assuming you mean to the cultural ethos of the country. And if you ask that, if it's really had an impact, I really will not make that much of an impact going forward. I know that sounds crazy to think, but we already have a system of white hegemony in place in the U.S. So when you think about that, when you think about why these protests happened in the first place, where Jacob Blake being shot in the back, it's not the first time we've heard about this. It's not the first time we've heard of a black man, whether he was unarmed or armed, being shot and either maimed by police or definitely shot and killed by police. This happens several times a year. We know that black men are disproportionately shot and killed by police more than their white counterparts. This has been, they were probably keeping records, this has happened. So at least in recent history, this has been the dynamic. So this is not going to be any different. And then when you have a white boy, now a white man, I guess, because he was 17 at the time, now he's 18, to be acquitted of all these charges, that's almost par for the course. When you think about Trayvon Martin and what happened there, where you had a white antagonist towards a black person, and then that black person is the person who ended up getting killed, but that person who was the original antagonist was acquitted. Now, even though in Kenosha it was white men who were killed, it's still the same type of dynamic because of the laws in this state of Wisconsin. And I think that's what a lot of people are angry about, because the optics are that you had this white boy who came in with a gun that is purposely designed to kill people, and he killed two people and maimed a third. And now he's going to be a free man like nothing ever happened, when you have right. people who are killed for much less of a crime.
Okay, so Life, the officer who shot Jacob Black, for example, let's take that case, seven times in the back, and I'm assuming seven times because he ran out of bullets, walked away, not even, you know, manslaughter charges, nothing, and he came from the same police department as the one that allowed Rittenhouse to march alongside the police carrying a dangerous firearm at a time with angry protests were going on. It's the police system, it's the justice system. How do you fix this racism?
You know, you've heard me say over and over again, the struggle for colonized people in the U.S. and around the world is not a struggle against racism. You know, the victorious people, courageous and victorious people of the Taliban weren't struggling in Afghanistan for some, against some kind of racism, against the oppressors not liking them. They struggled for power. They struggled for land. They struggled to be self-governing. And that's the real question here in the U.S. for colonized people. If people are upset with the Rittenhouse verdict, they shouldn't be upset with just this Rittenhouse verdict as if it's an isolated incident, as Colin so eloquently stated. This country, the United States, I don't call it a justice system. It's a criminal business system. It's a state apparatus of coercion. The only way that this colonial institution can maintain the hegemony that Colin referenced is through the most brutal and violent terroristic acts that they perpetrate on colonized people all the time. So the laws that allowed Kyle Rittenhouse to be a free person today are laws of that colonial system. And if people are upset with that verdict, then they ought to be upset with the system that from which that those laws come. We have to be in a position to declare a power and control over our own lives, to say what is just and what is not just, just like the ruling class can currently do, and in such a way that allows Kyle Rittenhouse to walk away. All these people out who are protesting and holding signs and expressing these different kinds of ideas of discontent with the verdict, should not isolate their energy and efforts to the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict. I mean, this thing has been in place since Nat Turner was put on trial for fighting against the slave master, which everybody now agrees slavery was a horrible institution, and the law put Nat Turner on trial and condemned him to death for fighting against that. So it's the same system. We got to be upset with the system.
Okay. Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. It's a serious issue and very serious points have been raised. Colin Campbell, our correspondent in Washington, D.C., and Life Malcolm, thank you very much indeed for your time and thoughts as well. Criminal defense and civil rights attorney joining us from Tampa. And that brings it end to another edition of the News Review.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello. I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Oh my god. These morning scenes are very tragic. I really can't see people crying and moaning. Before I forget, let me tell you one thing. We are going to visit a historical cemetery today. We are going to visit Sefid Shah Cemetery. Sefid Shah Cemetery, which is known as White Cemetery, is located in Behshahr County, Yanesar Division, Sefid Shah Village in Mazandaran Province. This cemetery dates back to 1,200 years ago. Sefid Shah Cemetery was registered in Iran's National Monuments List in 2003. Local people of this region believe that if they bury the dead body of their loved ones in this cemetery, the dead body won't get decomposed after the passage of time. However, it's not a myth, and there are signs of facts and evidence regarding this belief. According to the researchers on this cemetery, there is a considerable amount of lime in the soil, which causes the bodies buried there not to be affected by decomposition. Sefid Shah Cemetery has both upright and coffer-shaped headstones. The carvings on the upright headstones are in three types: Eslimi, geometrical, and symbolic. On top of a hill in the cemetery, there are some coffer-shaped headstones, which the oldest of them dates back to 896 AH. I am now in Sefid Shah Cemetery. This cemetery is not crowded today, and at this time of the day, its atmosphere is so mysterious that you might imagine that you have traveled to the past. A cool breeze is blowing, and the sound of the breeze has made an amazing atmosphere. A special feature of the Sefid Shah Cemetery is its upright headstones in the historic part of the cemetery. For your information, these types of headstones are very rare in Iran. On these headstones, the profession and age of the dead person is written. Also, beautiful designs have been carved on many of these headstones. The interesting point about this cemetery is that the gender of dead people are represented in a very special way. For example, if you see a two-edged comb on the headstone, it means that this grave belongs to a man. And if you see a one-edged comb on the headstone, it means that The grave belongs to a woman. And in this part of the cemetery, the graves are so close to each other that makes walking hard. Oh, something interesting. I am now standing in a part of the cemetery where almost all the graves are old. However, there is a new grave among them. It's a black upright headstone. Looks like a leaf. And on the leaf, there is the picture of an old woman wearing a white scarf with some gray hair showing up in one edge of the scarf. She looks like my deceased aunt. And nothing is written on this headstone. In the middle of the stone, something like a house is carved with a circle inside. And there are bizarre shapes on the edges of the headstone. Well, I don't know what exactly they are. Maybe something like dummies, which are carved very amateurishly. And here there is a huge tree. I'd better get seated beneath its shadow. The silence in this old cemetery is pregnant with meaning.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring
event.
In Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, it appears self-defense continues to be a crime for Palestinians and their supporters. Now, the British government is taking action to get the political branch of the Palestinian resistance group Hamas to be labeled as a terrorist group. This is taking place as Israeli aggression continues and building more illegal settlements are on the rise, as well as the destruction of Palestinian homes and the confiscation of more Palestinian land. So what does it all mean? Stay with us as we take a look at this on the Spotlight. I'd like to start this off by crossing over to London, joined by my colleague, Robert Carter. Well, tell us what exactly is going on and what this means.
Thank you. Yes, apparently it is a decision which has been in the works for quite some time. Reportedly, Israeli politicians, including the Prime Minister, has been trying to lobby the UK government to convince them to go ahead with this blanket ban. In fact, it was reportedly even discussed on the sidelines of talks in Glasgow recently, where world leaders met to discuss climate change. But the issue is a lot deeper than that. A lot of people are criticizing the move, despite the threat that any perceived support for the group could end up getting you up to 14 years in jail. Criticism has been coming in hard and fast. Things being mentioned as criticism include highlighting the fact that there is an alleged hypocrisy here, things that Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, has mentioned in regards to why she believes the ban is necessary on the political wing of Hamas, is things like they are deeply anti-Semitic, they hold a high amount of dangerous weaponry which could be used against Israel, for example. But critics are saying, well, if those are the criteria for a ban and sanctions, then surely the Israeli regime should also be sanctioned as well, as racism and heavy armaments are also something which is very prevalent within Israeli politics too. So there's that aspect of it, but also the fact that the British government right now is one of the most pro-Israel governments that the UK has had for quite some time. Priti Patel herself is well known for getting in trouble for illegal visits to Israel, where she met diplomats several years ago, and even the Prime Minister Boris Johnson has made very clear that he stands with Israel above all else. So obviously the move hasn't come into effect yet, but it's expected that a vote will take place later this week, and if it passes parliamentary approval, it will become enacted by the 26th of November latest.
And it is expected to pass, am I correct, Robert?
Yes, of course, there will probably be some opposition. Jeremy Corbyn, of course, is a politician which has condemned this type of move to ban Hamas as a terrorist organization in its entirety in the past, but he represents a minority left-wing view, which of course is unlikely to succeed. But there will be some opposition, but yes, most analysts say that it will pass.
All right, thank you so much for that update. Out of London, Robert Carter. I'd like to welcome my guest now to the spotlight, Mick Napier, Scottish from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Edinburgh. And Hafsatara Mustafa, journalist and political analyst and commentator out of London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with me. I'm going to start it off in London with Hafsa. Hafsa, why do you think that the UK Home Secretary, Priti Patel, has made this announcement at this time, and even she did it not in London but in Washington? Is there any significance at all to the timing of the location?
Well, Priti Patel has founded her political career on her steadfast support for Israel. She's an ardent Zionist. She'd actually been sacked from the previous government for colluding with the Israeli government, which in any circumstance would be considered high treason. But ironically, she was rewarded under Boris Johnson's premiership with one of the most important and sensitive posts in a cabinet. She's chosen to do it in Washington because, obviously, as we know, there is a very strong pro-Israel stance amongst the congressmen and women of Washington and the political class. And she has done it also in the aftermath of the booing of the Israeli ambassador who gave a lecture in a London university and who's booed rather mildly, really, by a handful of protesters, but which made the headlines and was deemed anti-Semitic and was blown out of all proportion in order to give great to reveal the current government's increased support for Israel. So everything that Priti Patel does is designed to show that she is a staunch supporter of Israel, and everywhere she does it and every way she does it is designed to reinforce that image and, of course, ensure that her political career remains protected.
Well, Mick, I mean, it doesn't sound much different than the British cousins across the way, the United States. I mean, what does it say for the basic lack of independence, whether we're talking about the UK or US, as far as the being able to separate themselves from being, whether we want to say coerced, influenced, or bought off by the Israelis? I mean, what does it mean for these countries in general?
You know, at one level, I can't answer that question because, you know, in the past, a lot of people used to believe that, say, Tony Blair was a poodle of George Bush. But the record began to show that he wasn't. He was actually a very aggressive promoter of war and invasion. He wasn't somebody who was bullied along. He was an active participant in the crime. And I'm not sure what the relationship is at the moment. It may well be that Johnson and Patel are very active promoters of this particular move. So they may have been pushed or they may have been very willing. I suspect it's the latter, but I don't know. Look, it's preposterous as well as sinister to label Hamas as a terrorist organization. Hamas is the elected representative of the people of Gaza and the West Bank, where such as elections are possible under occupation. They voted overwhelmingly for Hamas. Hamas is the representative of a people who are the victims of grotesque crimes. The Israelis have revealed documents, or documents have been leaked, to show they're counting the calories which they allow into Gaza per head. Leaked US State Department documents have shown that Israel is deliberately creating an economic disaster in Gaza, keeping it just on one side of total collapse, but keeping unemployment at 50, 60, 70% and so on. The deliberate infliction of pain and suffering, which could be ended in a week if the Israelis decided to end it, is a terrible crime. And yet the British government labels those who resist that crime in ways which are up to them as the terrorists. Now, the Israeli army has been the subject of innumerable investigations to prove that it's committing war crimes and very, very likely crimes against humanity. But it would never occur to Patel and Johnson, of course, to label the army to which they sell arms and sniper rifle parts included, to label them as terrorists. So
okay. It's
a world which doesn't surprise us, but the British government sells the weapons, supports the crime, and it's quite natural in a sense for them to label people who resist that crime as terrorists.
Well, Hafsa, what would be the main effects of such a ban or a terrorist designation in general?
Hamas has already been hugely isolated, so in effect this is not going to make much of a difference, but it does impact the small victories and the small things that can go into Gaza, essentially when it comes to transferring funds and working with charities, because everything has to go through the banking system and everything. Once an organization is labeled terrorist, that means that any assets that can go through a bank, which is then seen as working with a officially terrorist organization, means that the funds cannot go through, that the funds are frozen. The charities are not allowed to continue working in those territories. So in essence, it just makes the life of Palestinians in Gaza that much harder. It obviously is incredibly difficult at the moment already. But this move, which is essentially just an added layer of the current administration's Palestinophobia, if you want, and absolute slavishness to Israel, but it does increase just that little bit more the suffering of the Palestinians.
Well, Mick, the ban would make it illegal in Britain to be a member of Hamas or support the organization in any way, and carries with it a maximum penalty of 14 years in prison. But of course, as you said, alluded to, supporting the terrorist military IDF is welcomed in the UK. What does all of this mean, the hypocritical nature of the British government? I mean, do you think that people there are starting to see through this type of hypocrisy or not?
Well, they are and they're not, with the very limited information available to the British public, where, you know, public political debates very carefully managed. But with the information that's available, we know that majorities of the British public, and indeed across Europe, are hostile and very suspicious of the state of Israel, despite a massively favourable press coverage. But people don't know enough to understand that calling Hamas a terrorist organisation is part of an absolutely consistent position by the British government. When the British go to Kenya, seize the best land, give it to white farmers, and massively brutalize the native black people. The people who resist the Land and Freedom Army, the British called them the Mau Mau. When I grew up as a child, I was taught they were savages beyond the pale of humanity. And these were people who resisted their dispossession by a white supremacist regime. How many of you, look, this is an Iranian TV channel. How many people even know how Britain supported the Shah of Iran, helped to bring him to power, to inflict a reign of terror upon the people of Iran for decades? And that's just, these are just a couple of examples. But how many of your viewers even know that take the worst terrorist organization on the planet in the 20th century? We could possibly all agree it was the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, who killed maybe 2 million Cambodians. But how many people know that Britain supported that regime, that the SAS trained some of them after they had been defeated by the Vietnamese, that Britain every year when it came to the United Nations seat being allocated to the government that controlled 99% of Cambodia or the Khmer Rouge, voted for the Khmer Rouge? I mean, this is the basest, most bestial terrorist organization of the 20th century, possibly, and Britain supported it. So when Britain condemns Hamas as a terrorist organization, we have to understand that if you dissolve your opponents in acid, as the Saudi regime does, they're not terrorists. The weapons will continue to go from Britain to Saudi Arabia. There's no crime that any government or movement can commit except disloyalty to the empire. And Hamas is disloyal, and it thinks that Palestinians have a right to freedom and to move around the world like any other people. So therefore, they are terrorists. But no knowledgeable individual would take this seriously. But it is all too serious in its implications for the tortured people of Gaza and Palestine.
Well, Hafsa, let's look at this scenario. I mean, more Palestinians are being arrested and held without sentencing or trials. More Palestinian land is being confiscated. More Palestinian homes are being destroyed. More illegal settlements are being built on Palestinian land. More young Palestinians are being killed for simply protesting against Israeli violence. And this is, of course, in addition to the day-to-day humiliating checkpoints and harassment by Israeli soldiers and settlers. So what are the Palestinians supposed to do to resist their occupation when, of course, we know, according to international law, an occupied people has the right to resist?
Well, their only arm at the moment is to continue to exist, and that is really their only means of resistance. I mean, technically, any means that they use to resist this brutal criminal occupation is not only morally justifiable, it's actually legal under international law. However, with the most powerful nations on the planet blindly supporting the terrorist actions of Israel, we're in this sort of dystopian Orwellian scenario where good has become wrong and wrong has become good, and therefore the resistance of the Palestinian is deemed as terrorist, whilst the terrorist acts of Israel are hailed as the only as those of the only democracy in the Middle East. So if we are to judge by the supposed moral standards of Western nations, then they cannot do anything. But of course, they can do, and the only way that they can continue to resist is by existing. And we've seen it time and time again. Colonial powers all have a sell-by date. And the powerful do not remain powerful forever, and the weak do not remain weak forever.
Well, let's look at that. Let's open that up a little bit, what you just said, Hafsa. But I'm throwing this to Mick. I mean, because Mick, you had talked a little bit before about, in general, with the overall situation, and a lot of people not even knowing the reality of what happened. There's such a disconnect to history. And as Hafsa said, I mean, it's like everything is upside down. Good is considered bad. Bad is considered good. So where does that leave, for example, the people, let's say, on the ground? We'll say in the UK itself, as far as activists. Is it much as a disconnect between the reality or an apathy in general? I mean, how do you assess the overall situation?
I don't think it's an apathy. Well, apathy can mean one of two things. It can mean I don't care, or it can mean, look, what can I do about it? And it seems that the British government and others are closing off as many avenues as possible of political protest. I myself have been in court for 5 years for alleged anti-Semitism, which was just ludicrous. We won, but this is the harassment that many, many people face. Look, to call Hamas terrorists, they are in very good company. The Israeli government has just decided, has just categorized 6 human rights organizations in the West Bank and Gaza, Al-Haq and 5 others, who are prestigious, who are eminent, who are very well regarded internationally, but the Israeli government has called them terrorists. We need to understand what terrorism means. Terrorism means you resist your dispossession and your doom. And we have a prime minister in Israel, Bennett, who famously said, he boasted about it, I have killed many Arabs, I have killed a lot of Arabs, and I don't see a problem with it. And he's welcomed, and the weapons continue to flow to Bennett's army from Britain and America and so on. Ariel Sharon famously said, and it wasn't very original, it came from America 200 years earlier, but he said, the only good Arab is a dead Arab. And this is reported inside a cabinet meeting. And the weapons have continued to flow. It's not that the British government doesn't know about these things. They have a pretty good intelligence service who report back. They are much better informed than I am. But they continue to send the weapons. They have made a deal with Israel. They birthed the whole horror of Zionism 100-odd years ago. And they've continued consistently until the present day. We have to fight them. And by fighting, I mean, when the International Court of Justice ruled, I think 14 years ago, that the Israeli wall was a crime, and said that every country affiliated to the court had to take concrete action to have that wall removed. The end result was that more weapons were sold to Israel.
Let me just jump in there, Mick, with what you just said. I mean, so we have this International Criminal Court, and as you said, it ruled that the wall had to be removed. But who enforces it? I mean, so what does it mean? We've had statement after statement, condemnation coming out of the United Nations, but no enforcement when it comes to Israel. So at the end of the day, what does it mean?
The BDS call went out a year after that decision by the court, when it was clear that there was no action going to be taken. And the faith that Palestinians put is in civil society around the world. Since 2014, no Israeli ships have been unloaded in Oakland Port in California. The dockers there refuse to unload the Israeli ships. That needs to spread. Since that same year, I'm speaking to you from very near the biggest arts festival in the world. Since 2014, there are no Israeli participation, and there is no Israeli participation in that. We drove them out in 2014, and we will continue to make sure it's a no-go area. We need to boycott and isolate the apartheid state of Israel through grassroots campaigning, creatively and in a very determined way. We are the people we have been waiting for. There's no only resistance in the Middle East and boycott around the world can defeat Israel.
Hafsa, I mean, Hamas officials have said that the decision, if approved by the UK Parliament, would be a great political, moral, and legal sin committed by Britain and would only favor Israel. I mean, considering that London, of course, was the entity that established the illegal entity of Israel, what expectations should we have coming out of London?
Well, none very. I mean, I'm afraid I'm very pessimistic, and I'm going to say something that is hugely unpopular, but I think, in essence, the Jeremy Corbyn era has been very detrimental to the Palestinian cause, and I'll explain why. His failure to stand up to the Zionists, who very efficiently managed to link anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism, which had been sort of crushed many years beforehand, and which in the early 2000s had seen the pro-Palestinian movement develop and thrive, including under Tony Blair, I hate to admit. And so when he became leader of the Labour Party and faced this incredible anti-Corbyn campaign by the Zionists, his failure to stand up to them, his failure to say, no, I am an anti-Zionist or I'm a critic of Israel, but that doesn't mean that I'm anti-Semitic, has actually allowed the two notions to be merged. And today, within civil society, within mainstream media organization, within the public narrative and discourse, the idea that criticism of Israel is akin to an anti-Semitic crime has become entrenched in public discourse. And I think because of that, it's become very, very difficult to actually push the Palestinian cause and allow grassroots movements to develop and work and target Israeli businesses and interests the way they had done in the past. So I'm afraid if we are to rely exclusively on BDS, first of all, BDS was always a plus, but obviously not the be-all, end-all of Palestinian resistance. It's something that is useful, of course, but it's not the only thing that is there. But today, even that pacifist, even that sort of peaceful protest has actually been crushed and reduced to accusations of anti-Semitic actions because it targets Israeli business, which the media now calls Jewish businesses. And all this has been because under the Jeremy Corbyn administration, no resistance was made to challenge that narrative. So I think in the UK, what we're seeing is we're back 10, 15, even 20 years back with the Palestinian cause, whereby we're having to constantly remind people who need to be swayed and persuaded, that actually there is a distinction between calling out actions of Israel and, of course, anti-Semitism, in the same way that criticism of Saudi Arabia is in no way Islamophobic or Arabophobic. We can be hugely critical of this diabolical regime without in any way being an Islamophobe, and it's the same way with Israel. However, that narrative has not been allowed to develop, hugely because of Corbyn's failure to challenge it.
Mick, 30 seconds, final comment.
I mean... What our friend says is substantially true, but I don't believe that they have defeated the BDS movement. I think the fact that they tried to bring a ship into Auckland Port a few months ago, the dockers again refused to unload it and the ship had to leave. We know the Israelis are very afraid of the BDS movement. That explains the ferocity of their attack on it. The whole anti-Semitism, the fake anti-Semitism attack, is because they were very, very worried indeed. And the battle's not over, and it's not the side that controls the mass media that always wins. I think they know that popular opinion is hostile to them. We need to channel that hostile opinion into more and more effective action,
okay,
like Auckland, like Edinburgh, and around the world.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me on this spotlight. Mick Napier from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign of Edinburgh, and Hafsa Kara Mustafa, journalist, political analyst, and commentator out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar!
Khomeini rahbar, Allahu akbar. Khomeini rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shuma dar in qarn mojiza kardid, millat Iran, millat mojiza asay qarn ast.
Allahu akbar, Khomeini rahbar. Allahu akbar, Khomeini rahbar.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, The Man Who Changed the World. I'm Sayyid Jabari, here with our guest speaker, Dr. Mehdi Torabi, an expert and Islamic researcher. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for inviting me.
Today we have a quote from Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, where he says, superpowers want to suppress the humanity of humans. You know, what do you make from that?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is related to what we were speaking in the previous program about Imam Khomeini. We ended by saying that, you know, basically Imam was there to build, as all Muslims are supposed to, as all the religious leaders, whether it's Masum or Ghayr Masum, are there to build humans. And a real human being doesn't accept oppression, doesn't accept to be dominated, doesn't accept injustice. Doesn't allow himself to be oppressed. And this is one of the things that Imam used to tell us at the beginning of the revolution and as part of the struggle for the establishment of the Islamic Republic, is that they are really, that the dominating powers, whether it's Taghut, the governments within the Muslim countries in Iran, or their supporters, they don't want people to be real human beings. They want them to be, you know, in a way, creatures that are completely at the service of their lowly desires, who will be consumers of their products, who will be, you know, willing agents and executioners of whatever it is that those taqut and those powers want them to do. That they will not be liberated humans, that they will not be educated, that they will remain ignorant. And this relates to what we were talking about before, about how this revolution and how the Islamic Republic has so fundamentally transformed the lives of so many people in Iran for the better. Mm-hmm. From going from a very feudal, illiterate society, the majority of the people, considering even that glorious history that you would have, you know, even, you know, 5% or 10% of the population living in that state that they did in, at the time of, you know, the previous regime. But it wasn't just 5 or 10%. It was, you know, the vast majority. It was 70, 80% of the people who were like that. And so basically what Imam was talking about is that this America, these Western powers, don't want us to be real human beings. And this is related to what we were talking about and what's been going on in the news.
Yes.
Which is that, you know, when we're talking about having discussions with the West or with the Americans, and as the Supreme Leader has pointed out so many times, is you have to understand the nature of who you're dealing with. It's not about getting together for, you know, a few rounds of talks and that's it. You might do that on specific subjects, on very specific matters, but you cannot lose sight of the nature of who you're dealing with. And who you're dealing with, the way he says here, are powers and are people who don't want us to be real human beings. They don't want us to have knowledge.
This is why we see, like, Western superpowers with such an opposition to, you know, Islam and to an Islamic government and Islamic state, because, you know, Islam in reality is a religion of submission by definition, you know, but it's a religion of building humanity.
Exactly.
You know, it's submission to God, but it's a religion of building humanity. And, you know, the great alims, you know, that were during the revolution, that, you know, these Western superpowers were assassinating left and right.
Exactly.
You know, were telling us this, like Ayatollah Motahari.
Exactly.
You know, the, you know, great friend and, you know, colleague, you know, and companion of, you know, Imam Khomeini.
Exactly.
You know, he was telling us, you know, there's two types of freedom.
You know, the West is constantly shouting, you know, freedom, freedom, freedom. Mm-hmm. You know, we have freedom, you don't. But, you know, they don't even know what freedom is.
Exactly.
You know, he's telling us, you know, there's spiritual freedom, you know, and there's a physical freedom. You know, man is a complex, you know, being.
Exactly.
You know, we have lust, we have desires, we have anger, we have envy, you know.
Exactly.
If a person cannot control his own spiritual freedom, how can we expect a man to, you know, respect